please, senor. Not me. Take her. Take my daughter. Jacob looked up at her, away from the child's feet, his mouth still open with laughter, and was struck by the terror in her eyes. His laugh creaking to a close, he shook his head, thinking, God help me, if this is not the most wretched business.
Welcome back to Book Tour. In this fourth and final part of Toni Morrison's reading from A Mercy, the story continues from the point of view of the young girl called Florence, who's been given up by her enslaved mother. Florence is older now and in love with a free African blacksmith who fashioned an ironwork gate at her master's home.
Since your leaving, with no goodbye, summer passes, then autumn, and with the waning of winter, the sickness comes back, not like before with sorrow, but now with sir. When he returns this time, he is different, slow, and hard to please. He is short with mistress. He sweats and wants cider all the time, and no one believes the blisters are going to be sorrow's old sickness. He vomits at night and curses in the day. Then he is too weak to do either. He reminds us that he has chosen help, including me, who are survivors of measles. So how is this happening to him? He cannot help envying our health and feeling the cheat of his new house. I can tell you that even yet it is not complete, though your ironwork is wondrous to see. The glittering cobras still kiss at the gate's crown. The house is mighty, waiting only for a glazier. Sir wants to be taken there even though there is no furniture. He tells the mistress to hurry, hurry, never mind the spring rain pouring down for days. The sickness alters his mind as well as his face. Will and Scully are gone, and when we women, each holding a corner of a blanket, carry him into the house, he is sleeping with his mouth wide open and never wakes. Neither mistress nor we know if he is alive for even 1 minute to smell the new cherry wood floors he lies on. We are alone. No one to shroud or mourn, sir, but us. Will and Scully must sneak to dig the grave. They are warned to stay away. I don't think they wish to. I think their master makes them because of the sickness. The deacon does not come, even though he is a friend who likes sorrow. Neither do any of the congregation. Still, we do not say the word aloud until we bury him next to his children, and mistress notices too in her mouth. That is the one time we whisper it. Pox. After we say it, the next morning, the two on her tongue are joined by 23 on her face, 25 in all. She wants you here as much as I do. For her, it is to save her life. For me, it is to have one. You probably don't know anything at all about what your back looks like, whatever the sky holds, sunlight, moonrise. I rest there, my hand, my eyes, my mouth. The first time I see it, you are shaping fire with bellows. The shine of water runs down your spine, and I have shock at myself for wanting to lick there. I run away into the cowshed to stop this thing from happening inside me. Nothing stops it. There is only you. Nothing outside of you. My eyes, not my stomach, are the hungry parts of me. There will never be enough time to look how you move. Your arm goes up to strike iron. You drop to one knee. You bend. You stop to pour water first on the iron, then down your throat. Before you know I am in the world, I am already killed by you. My mouth is open. My legs go softly, and the heart is stretching to break. Night comes, and I steal a candle. I carry an ember in a pot to light it to see more of you. When it is lit, I shield the flame with my hand. I watch you sleeping. I watch too long. I'm careless. The flame burns my palm. I think if you wake and see me seeing you, I will die. I run away, not knowing then you are seeing me, seeing you. And when at last our eyes hit, I am not dead. For the first time, I am live.
We'll return now to the New York Public Library, where NPR's books correspondent Lynn Neary concludes her interview with novelist Toni Morrison.
I want to ask you about the voice of Florence. Each of these characters has such a distinct voice in this book, and it really reads like poetry, I think.
Oh, that's nice to hear.
Did you think of that as you were...
I didn't think about poetry. I thought about really lovely, interesting prose, which can have some of the attributes of poetry. For her, it was always the preciousness of language, because she can read and write.
Yeah. She is literate, but also it's she speaks in a way that...
She approaches language slant, almost. She was literate because a Catholic priest taught her and her mother how to read and write as a duty, and they learned... She's quickly shifted to another place. She doesn't understand what they're saying because she doesn't speak the language. She, little by little, she learns it. But she's kept this unique, or developed or invented, this new way to think. You can imagine the languages that she's exposed to. Portuguese, Latin, you know, from the catechism. Whatever Lena is speaking, as well as the English of three people who come from different parts. So she's smart. She put together a kind of way to tell this story that makes it purely hers. And I thought that the way to make it so distinctive was, first of all, not to have third person, but to use first. And if I kept it in the present tense, and also she reads the world. She not just reads text. She's full of what signs mean, what it means when you see snake die or steam change. You know, it's that deep, superstitious way of reading that many people did, by the way. I mean, they were always seeing signs and symbols and what it means if, you know, the kettle boils over before. So I wanted her to have those levels of an interior life, even though she's got one thing in mind, which is to get this man.
Get to the man.
Get to the man.
But you really have to go with her language, I think, to get into the character. Mm-hmm. You have to let yourself go into it, I think, at a certain point.
Well, when I read it, many people say, oh. When I read it, they can understand it better than just reading the lines. I had experimented with no punctuation, you know. And I thought, no, I don't think I can do that.
Well, I actually found myself reading it out loud, which I do with poetry a lot. A lot of times with poetry, I feel like I have to read something out loud to really understand it. And I felt that way a bit with Florence. At a certain point, I started reading it out loud so I could see where she was going. And that's what I mean. You really, the character is the language in many ways.
It's music for me, the music of her language, which is probably akin to what you mean when you say poetry, because it's very much sound and rhythm and emphasis, and just forcing her to never use the past tense was a discipline for me in her language, you know.
What's most interesting about it in many ways is that each story builds on the other. That at the beginning you're not entirely sure what's going on, and it takes a while, really maybe into the second chapter, before you really understand what Florence's story is all about. As you're reading about Jacob, you learn more about Florence's story.
And him,
and then when you read Lena's story, then that fills in more details, and on throughout the book. Why did you write it that way, in that sort of layered kind of way?
Well, the structure was... Absolutely, the meaning as well as the hardest part of any novel. But this one, I wanted her to be on a journey, going somewhere important, and I wanted her voice, which would cut into the other voices. So she's first person and present tense to give it mm-hmm. the immediacy. Mm-hmm. Everybody else is third person, but they have to not only be who they are and what they want and what their circumstances are, but they have to move that story a little bit.
Yeah.
So you're never out of the trek. You're never out, never away from the gun that's shooting toward the end, but at the same time, you can pause and look around you and see who these people are and learn their relationships, because they really are an interesting collection
oh, yeah.
of, as Lena says, orphans, really, who make a life in one of the few places where you could have all these extraordinary people come together and belong together. And then you just take one thing out, which is the man, and everything changes.
Right. Because at one point they almost come together as a family.
Absolutely.
Rebecca, who is Jacob's wife,
mm-hmm.
and Lena, mm-hmm. the young Native American woman, they're almost like sisters. They're certainly
That's
friends.
Right.
And but it's so ephemeral, and it can't hold
yeah.
together.
And even that young girl, Sorrow, who is a little bit apart from everybody, but they can absorb her. The indentured servants who don't live there, they work there. They like those people. It's a little society that they have created in the wilderness. And they are, and it works until it doesn't.
But why doesn't it? Why can't it? What is it about?
Well, I wanted this group to be sort of the earliest version of American individuality, American self-sufficiency. And I think I wanted to show the dangers of that. You really do need a community. You do need a structure, whether it's a church or a religion, as Rebecca thinks, or whether it's just belonging to a military or belonging to a tribe. There's no outside thing that holds them together. They would not have missed it had the master had lived. But if you have to, if you have one peg that's holding it all together, then you see how vulnerable you
yeah.
are if you don't have this outside thing, which is tribal or racial or religious or institutional or just, colleagues and workers to hold it together when other things disappear. But that's the tension. Then, in an ad hoc world, and it's the tension now. How to be an individual mm-hmm. in yourself, and how to adore privacy and at the same time belong to something larger than you are.
Mm-hmm.
And that tension is always going to be there. Always.
I can see how it's still here now, but back then, as you say, this group of people, without Jacob Vark, they were so vulnerable. They had... Anything could have happened to
sure.
them, really.
Yeah.
They had no power. They were completely powerless.
They're not, and everybody but Rebecca, who probably she owns that land. But think of those people who have no last names, who don't belong to anything, who are on no register, and have no ID, I guess we would call it. And if they don't have any close friends who can vouch for them, in a village sense, they really are lost.
And they're valued then really only as property.
That's right. They have no other meaning. The indentured servants are working, trying to get their freedom fee, which for them means a horse. Just get out. So there's the bounty, there's the richness, there are all these possibilities, and there is danger. But there's also this extreme frailty outside of your home or your society, particularly if you are like this group, because one of the thrills of their being together was that they could do it by themselves.
How much research did you have to do? How much did you know about this time period before you began the book?
Well, I thought I knew a lot. I knew nothing. I had to really start with... the landscape, what was here? What did it look like? And not the sort of paintings that are 100 years later But all the letters asking people to come were about bounty and beauty and danger, and but being flush. So I began with Changes in the Land, which is an extraordinary book. But it tells you what plants were here, the flora, the fauna, how tall the trees were. You can't write about dandelions in a field if there were none.
Mm-hmm.
You can't take for granted anything in the scenery unless you've really explored what these people who really know, anthropologists and biologists, of what plants were really here, what birds were really here, what the black flies were.
Yeah.
You know, those are the details. And once I got comfortable in that environment, then I could figure out other kinds of things.
Jacob Vark, the master character, is traveling through Virginia to mm-hmm. Maryland, and he lives in the north.
Yes.
And it's so vivid the way he feels the heat of,
yes.
of the South.
He's horrified. And gnats and mosquitoes yeah. and so on.
Now, Vark, in many ways, he's a very sympathetic character in a lot of ways.
Yes, yes.
And he is repelled by slavery when he goes to this plantation. He seems to be repelled by slavery, and yet he accepts Florence to pay off a debt.
Yes, that's a kind of act of generosity on his part. He really doesn't want to buy any slaves. And he's repelled by the ownership of a human being. He only purchases her because her mother begs him, falls on her knees and says, please take her. And then he rationalizes it a little bit. Maybe his wife would like it. But also, this is a man who was himself an orphan.
Mm-hmm.
And his conviction is, whatever Dickens was doing with orphans on the street, children with no one to take care of them were just lost. So he takes her. However, as repelled as he is by the planter with whom he makes this deal mm-hmm. and his own slaves, and it's sincere with him, he is able to do another thing,
right.
which is to benefit from the slave labor if it is somewhere else.
Yeah, because he goes into the sugar trading.
He goes into sugar trading.
And he knows that that's based on
that's
slave
right.
labor. And I wanted to ask you about that because, as I said, you like the character, and then you think, well, how can he rationalize it?
Those morals were not the ones we have now. They didn't think about that way. When the man tells him, listen, there are as many Africans willing to sell slaves to as many Portuguese who will sell them to the French, to the English, whatever. That is actually true. Our sensibilities, I suppose, have evolved. And what seems to us absolutely, you know, terrible, how could you? Look at this young girl who is the heroine, I suppose, of the book Florence. She's not disturbed because she's enslaved. She doesn't even know what mm-hmm. that means. Everybody is. And she's on a wagon, and they say, we're running away. And she says, but doesn't everybody have to work? I mean, it's the way of the world.
Yeah.
Now, what destabilizes her, a couple of things, but first, when she realizes in that village that she her color of her skin...
That people stare at her.
Stare at her. Yeah. And it's that the darkness... is what is loathed. And she had never thought about that before. She was with a Native American, she was with this, she saw white people, she saw black, and they were all, you know, workers. But when she learns or begins to feel, when they examine her as though she were a demon, because they're thinking about the possibility of witches in the neighborhood.
Yeah.
I mean, that's destruction. So her journey toward her hopeful, good life with a lover who is also black is much more intense now.
A lover who is also black and who is a free man.
Is free.
Where did he come from? How was that possible? I didn't know that was possible.
Well, I had a notion of giving him a name and a life that was as detailed as the characters, but I thought, no, I want an African who has a trade. And there were many who came to this country not enslaved or anything. They just came, like everybody else, to do some work and see the world. And he's that. He's never been a slave. He not only has he never been a slave, he comes from a group of people in Africa who are craftsmen. He works iron. And that has been a chief occupation handed down from one generation to the next since the 10th century.
How common was that for somebody like this character to come from Africa as a free man? Was that a common situation?
Common enough. You know, there were people in New York who did that. You know, the oyster houses of New York. There were people who were adventurers who traveled the world. And some of them came to the New World. Not enough, certainly not more than the ones who were being shipped for labor. But there were enough of them so that there were people here who, among whose ancestors there were never slaves.
Let me ask you just a little bit more about Lena, that character, that Native American character, because she's a very compelling character, I think. And I do think a very sad character, and maybe the loneliest character. In the end, I sort of felt like, where does Lena go from here?
Well, she's a survivor of total devastation, carrying the shame of having been one of the, there were just three of them, children, who didn't die. And it's a kind of shame or guilt.
Survivor guilt.
Survivor guilt. So she has to invent her life. As a child, she's taken to this place. Her one sort of illegal encounter with a male is disastrous. And she's taken to Jacob's farm. And she's this process, a creative process of inventing a life for herself. What she remembers of being in her tribe, in her clan. What she remembers of being with the Presbyterians. What she remembers of being... She makes a history and a mythology for herself. But what is interesting is her affection. She really loves her mistress. They really are friends, because they have to be. You can't live out there in the wilderness and have rank. She likes her mistress's little girl, but she doesn't own her. I mean, it's not her child. So when Florence comes along...
It's like her child.
It's like her child. And that she sticks to. She promises to protect her, and that's what she does from everything. And she can only use her own experience in seeing what's dangerous. She thinks the free African is going to ruin them all. And it's true that there is some melancholy because her mistress, for her own survival, turns into a very strict, narrow-minded church religion. And she has only Florence, but Florence has changed. But I think what one of the indentured servants, Scully, says about her is true. It's not servility. It's not just surrender. It's her core of loyalty, which means more to her. In other words, if she's going to be loyal to you, it's not going to be based on whether you're a good person. It's going to be based on her sense of what loyalty is.
Well, in the end, each of these characters really, I think, finds, or most of them do, finds something within themselves that gives them the dignity they need to live in this place. And as much as it's a story of enslavement, it seems to me it's also a story about freedom, because that's what Florence.
Yeah, they grow up in some instances. They take charge in instances. Look at Sorrow, the one that had the least possible room for being anything except a damaged child. Plaything, almost. But when she has that baby, it makes all the difference in her life and the world. Now, she has an other, she has a self, she's somebody. And she names herself complete.
complete.
So they do grow. I mean, it is, you know, my version of happy endings is not, you know, sweet violins, but if somebody learned something they didn't know before through the activity of the novel, if this may be an epiphany or maybe just a movement toward maturity or recognition of something, that seems to me to be not only the point, but kind of reconciliation even. In some instances, happiness.
Thanks for joining us on this special edition of Book Tour. For more readings and discussions like this one, visit npr.org/booktour.